The recent insider trading scandals have rocked Wall Street, the financial community, the securities industry, have moved off of the business pages and onto the covers of our news magazines and the front pages of our newspapers. The impact is being felt around the world. One of those stories is about a 36-year-old man named Nahum Vascovich, who was the head of the Department for International Mergers at Merrill Lynch's London office. He was involved in an insider trading scheme, including his partner David Sofer in the city of Jerusalem. And through the inside information that he had and the deals that were struck, 12 of them, the two men profited to the tune of over $4 million in the buying and the selling of stocks, including such familiar places as Herman Sporting Goods and Kmart and Payless Drugs. Their dealings were clearly dishonest, were wildly profitable, and were very, very shrewd. So they held a great deal in common with the steward about whom we have read in the parable of Luke 16, a parable that some have said is the most difficult of all Jesus' parables to understand and to explain. It is the rather strange story of how the key character robs and tricks his master. And when the parable comes to a conclusion, the master turns around and commends the steward for being so shrewd. It's somewhat amazing that Jesus should even tell this story, for it seems in its content to be so contradictory to everything for which Jesus and Christianity stand. It even has some scholarly problems about it, for the scholars disagree on when the parable concludes, some saying that it's somewhere toward the end of verse 7, others saying it's in the middle of verse 8, some saying the end of verse 8 or on into verses 9, 10, 11, 12, 13. It has been called by some the rascal parable, for it seems that all the characters in it are rascals. The steward, he wastes his master's money and then manipulates the accounts of his master in order to get personal profit for himself. So he was a rascal, to be sure, but even the debtors were rascals in that they became co-conspirators with the steward in gaining profit for themselves in the discounting of their accounts. Even the master is something of a rascal, that he at the end of the parable should turn to his steward, who has taken thousands of his dollars and tricked him thoroughly, and then the rascal of a master commends his steward for that which he has done. What a story for Jesus to tell to his disciples. I mean, what could possibly be the point of such a bizarre parable? Ah, you must remember again that parables are a literary form where there is a single point that is being made, a single truth that is being communicated, and that it was never intended that the specific contents of the parable in the story necessarily stand in all of their subpoints. What the parable is about, as far as Jesus telling it, is not the steward's dishonesty, but the steward's shrewdness. How clever he was. He was an extraordinarily clever character, and that's the way God wants us to be. So then, the point of the parable is that we are to zealously pursue God, cleverly, shrewdly pursue God amidst the crises of life. And crises are part of life. They certainly were for this steward. It would seem that his life was lived from one crisis to another. We don't know what the initial one was that precipitated his wasting the master's money in the first place, but something had run amok. And then he moved on from that to being entrusted with another man's goods and misusing them. And he had to know that trouble was coming. And he faced a dilemma. A dilemma, I suppose, that is faced by every embezzler, and that is how to cover your thefts. And in all probability, he got in deeper and deeper. You may rightly accuse me of reading more between the lines than is actually there, but I cannot help but wonder from the experiences of others of which I have heard that perhaps he was a gambler who had debts that had to be paid, or maybe he had a drug habit that had to be underwritten. You know, the abuse of drugs is not something that is unique to our century or to our culture. Or maybe he had family medical bills to pay, or maybe he had a mistress to support. Or perhaps Perhaps he was being blackmailed. Or maybe he was just plain greedy or simply incompetent, although the cleverness with which he does his other things would seem to contradict any accusation of him being all that incompetent. Well, the inevitable happened, and he was caught. So one crisis gave way to another crisis. What was he next going to do? How was he ever to get another job as good as that job with these types of responsibilities and that type of remuneration? And if he couldn't get another job like that, how could he go out and be a laborer? He wasn't able, strong enough, to dig ditches. Nor was he willing to become a beggar and to get into the welfare system of his day, which was begging alms out in the streets of the major cities. He wasn't about to do any of those things, and so he faced yet another crisis. His life, in essence, was one crisis after another. But I think we understand that, because crises are a part of our lives. Crises are part of everyone's life. Sometimes because we're like the steward, victims of our own decisions, victims of our own sins, where we have dug our holes deeper and deeper until it hardly seems likely that there is any way that we could climb out. It may go back to early in our lives. Perhaps because of choices that we made, we did poorly in school, and poorly in school led to difficulty in getting a job, and difficulty in getting a job led to financial reverses, and financial reverses caught us up in the wrong crowd, and the wrong crowd led to the wrong marriage, and the wrong marriage, and on until crisis after crisis after crisis, largely of our own doing. Or to the other extreme. Sometimes the crises that we face have nothing to do with our initiative. They are things where we are far more the victim than the perpetrator. Bob Buford is a friend of mine with whom I spent some time this past week. He lives in Tyler, Texas. He's a man in his 40s who has been extraordinarily successful in business, in the television industry. It was last summer that I met his only child, actually, 24-year-old Ross, who is, in a sense, his father's heir apparent and a businessman of success himself. Ross decided on January 2nd with two of his friends to take on sort of an epic adventure. The three of them decided that they were going to swim the Rio Grande River from Texas into Mexico and try to cross the border back into the United States and experience what illegal Mexican aliens do when they try to gain entry into our country. Now, he had swum the Rio Grande before. He's a man in good shape, an experienced swimmer. But the last time he swam the Rio Grande, it was in the summer and not the winter. And in the winter, the river runs 4 feet higher, and the current's faster. Perhaps most important of all, the temperatures are colder. And he and one of his friends didn't make it. And Bob Buford had what seems to me to be one of life's most painful responsibilities, and that was to be part of the search party for his only child's body. Crisis. Not of his choosing, nor of his doing. But that's the stuff of which life is made. Crisis. Crises range from the little annoyances that every single one of us had this morning, all the way through to the death, the unexpected and untimely death of one's only child. Crises, one after the other. We kid ourselves sometime. I think it's a way of making for hope, imagining that when today's crisis is over, or the thing which has so dominated our thinking in 1987 is past, then at last we'll be able to get on with life and enjoy it. Except the truth of it is, and we know the truth deep down inside, that today's crisis will be succeeded by tomorrow's crisis as surely as the sun will rise in the east. Life is made up of crisis after crisis. It's part of life, and it must be realistically faced. That's what the steward of the parable learned, that he had to realistically face his crises. And so he did. And for that, I think he ought to be commended. He did not hide his head in the sand. He did not just hope that the problem would go away. He did not unrealistically think that if he ignored it, that somehow it would self-solve. And he didn't deceive himself into thinking that he could do that which was unlikely to happen. He didn't think that he could just get another job just like the last job. He didn't think that he was as young and fit as once he was so that he could get a job as a laborer. Nor did he deceive himself into underestimating his pride that he could go out on the streets and become a beggar. He didn't even blame other people. Wouldn't most of us be prone to put the blame on another? This steward acknowledged his problem and he decided to do something about it. In that regard, I like him because I think he understands what I believe to be one of the basic principles of life. And that is to acknowledge that what's most important is not what happens to us, but how we respond to that which happens to us. For everyone has crises. It's just that some face them realistically and some do not. Let none of us think that our problems are unique or that we are the only ones who have problems. Problems are everybody's experience. It's just that they're different. For one, it's a lost job. For another, it's a severe illness. For yet another, it's a family rift or a broken dream or an enslaving habit. And when we think that we would like to exchange our problem and our crisis for someone else's, we simply show our ignorance of the difficulties that others live with. Very few of us who have gone through a week gone by with problems at work, if we really understood the plight of the person who is unemployed, would be likely to change our difficulties in our present job with the unemployment that someone else faces. But those who have gone through painful days of unemployment and are hard put to find another job and the difficulties are crushing down are those who probably would not exchange their crisis for the person who is going through an agonizing divorce. A person whose heart is being ripped out with the agony of a deteriorating relationship that was dreamed to be the best that there ever could be. But let me also say that as hurt as you may be by your divorce, and as deep as the wounds may be running, I doubt that you would trade your crisis and your problem for someone who recently had a heart attack. For while the emotional agony has been great, at least you say, I have life and I can go on with life. But the person who has had the heart attack may be wondering if today is the last day and wondering if the heart will, with a sudden stab of pain, bring an unexpected end to life's journey. But then those who have had the heart attack would probably not be too likely to trade with those who are suffering from AIDS. For at least there's hope with a heart attack and not the seeming certainty of death with AIDS. So whether chosen or inflicted, whether seemingly safe or severe, the thing to do with a crisis is what the steward did. To face it realistically, to admit wrong, to reckon resources, and to decide how to respond. This particular steward decided on bold action because he figured that a crisis requires bold action. He thought it through. He thought it through to the point that he concluded that he wasn't rich enough to retire and he wasn't strong enough to labor and that he was too proud to beg. What he figured he needed was some friends. Because when you're really down and when you're really hurting, if you have friends, they'll come to your rescue. So that there would at least be a floor on which he could sleep. There would at least be a table where he would be given something to eat. There would at least be someone who would share his plight and seek to help him in finding some new employment and some type of remuneration. So in order to get those friends, he devised a bold and clever plan. First, he invited one at a time the major debtors of his master. He had represented his master to them, and so he knew their accounts and he knew them well. One at a time, he brought them in, and to each he offered deep discounts for quick payments on past due accounts. Attempts have been made by scholars to sort of translate from first century Palestinian economy to 20th century American economy, and it is very, very difficult to do. Usually the way it's done is in terms of what would be a laborer's annual or daily wage. But no matter how you figure it, large amounts of money were involved here, thousands of dollars, in all probability tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of dollars. He offered deep discounts if they would pay now. And he figured then that the debtors would not only be delighted with the discount, because when his successor, the next steward, would come along, in all probability, he would require full payment. So they would not only be delighted in the discount, but also they would become co-conspirators with him. So they would be obligated to him, and he would be obligated to them, and that would be the basis of their friendship. He also figured that the boss would be more lenient because the cash flow would be far better than he had anticipated when he discovered the embezzlement that was taking place. It was a brilliant plan. You really got to hand it to this guy. He is smart. He is shrewd. Brilliant. And the master knew it. Even though the steward was dishonest, and even though he had already announced that he was going to fire the guy, and even though he had hoodwinked him out of tens of hundreds of thousands of dollars, the master commended the dishonest steward for his shrewdness. Luke 16 says. And that's the end of the parable. And we have not yet come to the end of the service. Strange parable, isn't it? Don't you find it kind of bizarre? Did you notice something, though? Did you notice that everything so far said we could have figured out without God or Jesus or the Bible? I mean, we could have figured out from any religion, from common sense or from life's experience, that crises are part of life. We know that. I don't think God has to tell us that. We know that crises must be realistically faced. You don't need the Bible to tell you that. All you need is a counselor, or all you need is a keen sense of observation. And we can figure out that crises require bold action. That is not a necessarily Christian principle. That's everybody's principle. So what's the point? What's the point of the parable? The point is for us to zealously, shrewdly pursue God amidst life crises, just as the steward pursued success. That we are to be as God-driven as he was self-driven. That we are to be as clever finding ways to God as the steward was clever finding ways to success. That we are to be as hungry to save our souls for eternity as the steward was hungry to save his hide for time. That we are to zealously, shrewdly pursue God amidst the inevitable crises of life. Do we do that? Do we zealously pursue God? Do we pursue God as zealously as the inside traders pursue a profit in the financial industry? Are we as zealous and shrewd and clever and smart in our pursuit after God in the midst of our crises as the politicians are in Washington to resolve the Iran-Contra affair? In fact, do we use our greatest smart to pursue after God and his impact on our lives? Or do we use our greatest smarts to get the best interest rate on a mortgage? Or to get the best buy on a car? Or to get the best physician for our malady or the best attorney for our lawsuit? The question is whether or not we use what we have as our very best and the highest goal of life is to pursue zealously God amidst the crises of life. Jesus says in verse 8 at the end of it that the truth is that the non-Christian in our world is more zealous in living within his generation for himself than we as his disciples are in living for him. He says the sons of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own generation than the sons of light. He's right. Non-Christians often operate smarter business dealings than Christians seeking the kingdom of God. What Jesus is here saying is, give your best. Whatever that is, give your best, your smartest, your shrewdest, your most zealous to pursuing God. That's where our best efforts belong, and that's where our energy ought to go, and that's where our smart should be deployed. That explains this in some application in the verses that follow. For example, in verse 9, he talks about unrighteous mammon. It's kind of a put-down. It's a Semitic expression that refers to money, and he recognizes the problems that come with money. He says in verse 9, use that money to make the kinds of friends who will get you to heaven. Is that the way we use our money? Or in verse 10, he says, be faithful in the little things of life, but do it for God. Or in verse 11, he explains that if you aren't diligent enough to use your money now for God, then what makes you think that he'll entrust you with real wealth someday in heaven? And in verse 12, he says, if you won't zealously give proper care to what God has entrusted you, what makes you think that he'll entrust you with something more? And in verse 13, which is one of the most famous verses in this chapter, he says, you've got to decide if God or money, mammon, is going to be number one in life or something else. Because he says there can't be more than one number one. Question. When you walk out of here this morning, you think you're going to understand the rascal parable of the steward who switched? And it'll make any difference? It's a tough parable. Difficult to understand, and let me tell you, it's difficult to explain. Perhaps it would be good if I told you a story, a modern story, that would help us understand the ancient story of Jesus. Several years ago in Omaha, Nebraska, there was a 10K race scheduled. And one of the runners who signed up for it was a man named Bill Broadhurst. The reason he signed up for that race is because Bill Rogers was running in that race. And his life's dream was to run in a race with Bill Rogers. The day of the race came, and like a lot of these long-distance races in major cities, there was a huge number of people at the starting line, including both Bill Broadhurst and Bill Rogers. But with the shot of the gun, the similarities came to a quick end. In case some of you don't know, Bill Rogers is one of America's all-time great long-distance runners. He led the race all the way, finishing the 10 kilometers in something under 29 minutes. Bill Broadhurst was at the back of the pack from the time the gun was shot. You see, Bill Broadhurst had suffered in his childhood an aneurysm in the right side of his brain that had severely handicapped the left side of his body. And so it was only with great difficulty that he could walk, much less run. The side of his body was stiff, and the pain was great. In fact, after an hour, Bill Broadhurst hadn't even run the first 5 kilometers. And just about everybody else had finished the race. The pain was so severe that they thought about quitting. But more than the pain, he wanted to finish a race they had run with his hero, Bill Rogers. After 2 hours, he was still running. Everyone else had finished. The race was over. Children along the side of the road laughed at him, and they mimicked him, and they ran alongside, dragging their left legs the way he did. After 2 hours, 20 minutes, it was starting to get dark in Omaha. And he was still running alone. At 2 hours, 30 minutes into the race, he was near the end, and he saw it. But the sign, the banner for the finish line had been taken down. There was no one there. But he kept running. And as he closed into the finish line, there was a crowd of people who had heard, who were waiting in an alley, who came running out, yelling and shouting, led by Bill Rogers, who stood at the finish line with his arms open wide, and at 2 hours, 35 minutes into the race, Bill Broadhurst ran into his hero's arms. And Bill Rogers took off his gold medal and put it over the neck of Bill Broadhurst and said, "You are the winner." My fellow disciples, pursue God as zealously and diligently as Bill Broadhurst pursued the finishing of the race. Yes, life's crises are tough and difficult, but Jesus Christ himself stands at the finish line with his arms wide open. Zealously pursue him amidst the crises of life's race.